uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
What are you guys going to do for Thanksgiving?
I am already at my in-laws. We're splitting the cooking up three ways, so I'll be doing that. Starting as soon as I am done with work today. What about you?
We've got a friend coming over. We live pretty far away from... My family's in Texas. I'm in South Carolina, so we make the trip for Christmas, but not for Thanksgiving. So we have friends come over.
Classic.
And we do like a... We're doing a big meal here.
Cool. That's great. What about you, Emily?
Yeah, I'm making the trek out to Long Island tomorrow morning because I refuse to take the Long Island Railroad the Wednesday night before Thanksgiving.
I took it once when I was going to my in-laws for Thanksgiving, and there were like kids that seemed like they were on the precipice of throwing up from drinking so much on
Hell
the train.
Yeah, there were.
I was like really could not get farther. I was so close to them, and I was like, this is just going to end so horribly.
Look, I've seen it all on the Long Island Railroad. It's a rail service of magic, whatever that kind of magic is, whether it be like dark magic or, you know, good magic, who's to say?
I think that's definitely right.
Your mileage may vary.
Yeah.
It's funny. I didn't think about like the need to get really messed up before you go home for Thanksgiving when you're like 22.
Seems like it's a rite of passage for certain people heading east from Brooklyn.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's also like, you know, there's the Thanksgiving tradition in many a suburban hometown of, you know, going to the local bar that you were not old enough to go to when you were in high school to then see all of
right.
the people. Not something that I have ever partaken in or have any desire to do, but...
Oh, that I've done.
Some of the... Like, one version of that is also going to the city from Long Island, getting super trashed at whatever shitty bar that you and your friends would get trashed at when you were in high school. Part of the thing, too, is that you can drink open container on the Long Island Railroad, but there are a couple of days every year that you can't.
That is a big part of it, I would say.
Yeah, they used to sell, like, they used to have, like, little, like, wine carts on the platform, so you could get, like, a little can of wine. But the big thing is you get beer in a giant plastic cup with a straw. Like, in, like, a giant, like, soda cup that you would get at, like, McDonald's or whatever.
Right.
That is, like... The pinnacle.
You can't do that all the time?
No,
I thought that was all
you can't
the time.
Do that on, I think, the day before Thanksgiving.
Really?
And St. Patrick's Day. Or maybe it's like New Year's and St. Patrick's Day. I forget exactly what the deal is, but needless to say, the way that you get around that in high school is by buying a Gatorade at the local, you know, train station bodega and putting whatever amount of shitty plastic, you know, jug vodka you can find in there.
Work around.
And I'm not even, you know, I'm personally not saying this from experience and not even fronting about that, but I've witnessed it firsthand.
Underage drinkers are nothing if not innovative.
Yeah, really.
The southern version of that is go to Sonic and get a Route 44 sized drink, just like this massive 44 ounce soda, and then you pour out some of it and put your preferred spirit in there.
I've heard that Sonic's ice is very good.
Oh, it's
they have
amazing.
Like a very specific ice cube shape.
Yeah, it's like these tiny little balls. I don't know how to explain it, but it's perfect. And everyone should try Sonic once in their life. It's one of America's finest foods.
Sonic sponsor us.
You know what? I think I'm going to have Sonic for lunch tomorrow, pre-Thanksgiving.
God bless.
It's open. It's one of the only places here that's open 24/7 and like every day. So
I feel like it's legendary to people who have not had it. I've never had it, and I've been like, you know, it's on my bucket list. I don't know if it's worthy of that, but it definitely is.
No, it's going to be like, it'll be like when In-N-Out Burger started coming into Texas, and all the people that from California loved it. Everyone that was here that already had Sonic and Whataburger were like, this is not, what is this with this California shit? Get this out of here.
I went to a DQ for the first time when I was in Washington State over the summer. Surprisingly, it was like the DQ in the Walmart parking lot Kurt Cobain's hometown.
Hell yeah.
Which is just like various levels of like suburban ennui that I'm like, wow.
You really understand him now.
Yes.
The lyrics, they make more sense.
Dairy Queen is legitimate. Let's not pretend it's not. It's great. It's great.
I mean, I had some very good chicken fingers. Like, literally, no complaints.
Ice cream like 75 different ways. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with that.
Exactly.
So we're actually here to talk about a bunch of your reporting, Maxwell. Can you introduce yourself? And then we'll get into it a little bit.
Sure. I am Maxwell Strong. I'm a reporter at Motherboard. I cover technology, focus on sort of financial issues.
So we're having this lovely Thanksgiving conversation the day before Thanksgiving. It is November 22nd. At this moment, right now, at 11 a.m., who is in charge of OpenAI?
That is a very good question. And I think the fact that I can't give you a super hard answer is maybe evidence of how chaotic things have been. I mean, de facto, the answer is Sam Altman once again. He's agreed to come back and join the board. I don't know if the paperwork is signed. So, you know, it could technically for a few more minutes still be the Twitch CEO, Emmett Shear, who was CEO for, I don't know, a couple hours or something like that. So, for all intents and purposes, Sam is back in charge after a pretty crazy 5 days or so.
What the fuck is going on? What happened? And I know, this is something I've been thinking about, Emily. I know that I have to stop cursing at least in the first 10 minutes when we move to YouTube. So,
I'm bad at that too. So we'll have a swear jar, a virtual swear jar.
We need a cyber swear jar. But what happened 5 days ago? Like, what is going on over there?
Sure. So the long and short of it is that, the board, which is a very, very particularly small board, that is a strange collection of people, to be honest, was basically at odds with one another for a long time, over some sort of philosophical differences, seems like maybe some personal differences, and, one faction that's more academic, more doomery about AI sort of, formed on one side, and Sam Altman and Greg Brockman, who's kind of, you know, one of his allies, underlings, I guess you could say, he was the president, on the other side. And the board made a move. I think there were, outside of Sam and Greg, just four people that made this decision. Only four people that caused all of this news. Came together and decided that they would push Sam out, demote Greg, and Greg later quit. So, I mean, we can get into the reasons of why they decided to do that and what the philosophical differences were, but that's the thing that sort of precipitated everything that's happened since then.
Let's back up a little bit. I know I'm kind of jumping around in our map here, but I want to put OpenAI, the company, into like some sort of corporate context for people before we start dissecting them. This is kind of like, if you didn't know much about the company other than like its financials, it's kind of a fairy tale startup, right? Like, what's their evaluation at? Like, how long have they been around? How much money are they making?
Sure. I mean, yes, in lots of ways, they are a fairy tale startup story. I mean, they are valued at something like $80 billion, I think, maybe had been looking for money that would value them at 90. You know, they were, I think, valued at $30 billion a year ago. So that's, you know, the 3X that you're looking for if you're a startup in a single year. They had this charismatic founder, Sam Altman, who's one of the most well-connected people in Silicon Valley, was the head of Y Combinator, which is this, you know, really influential startup accelerator in the Bay Area. And most importantly, they had two products that had really, I mean, inarguably taken the world by storm, in ChatGPT, which you'd be hard pressed to find someone who doesn't know what that is at this point, and Dolly, which was the sort of text to image generator that kind of took the world by storm, I think, before ChatGPT. So, I mean, all of those things combined, you know, you have the profile of, you know, a generational startup. And a lot of people had talked about Altman, you know, regardless of what they thought about him, as being, you know, the Mark Zuckerberg of the 2020s, you know, or the Bill Gates or the Jeff Bezos. I mean, that was kind of the sense that people had. This person was going to define the world of AI and be the public face of it in the same way that Zuckerberg became the face of social media. Now, what there are some key differences between OpenAI and your typical startup that really paid a key role in what we've seen happen over the last 5 days. And, you know, I can go into that history or not, but the long and short of it is that it started as a nonprofit. It was not actually started as a sort of for-profit, typical, you know, raise venture capital, prepare to IPO company. It was started as a nonprofit organization that sort of transitioned and transformed in a lot of ways into a more traditional powerhouse startup. And that caused a lot of the corporate weirdness that that we've seen today.
Yeah, it's like, I feel very silly because I keep getting Sam Altman and Sam Bankman-Fried mixed up. And it's not just because their first names are both Sam, but there's some effective altruism kind of running throughout this whole thing. And that's kind of part of the reason, like, why it seems to me, or from what I've been reading of your work and other people saying, there's a lot of like the philosophical differences between the effective altruism and then also effective accelerationism.
Yeah. Effective altruism just keeps popping its head into every major catastrophe occurring in the technology sector somehow. But the way that effective altruism is popping its head in here is very different from the way that it popped its head into the FTX thing. So at FTX, Sam Bankman-Fried was a hardline believer in effective altruism. And as part of their philosophy, it was make as much money at all costs so that you can then donate it or use it to save the world in through X, Y, or Z. And so in that philosophical school of thought, you know, it didn't matter how the money was made. It didn't matter if it was made unethically, as long as it was accumulated and then used to save the world. Effective altruism has this other aspect, though, which is a sort of doomerism related to artificial intelligence, a real fear that AI could, you know, end the world, the robots take over, Terminator kills everyone, that sort of thing. Now, Sam Altman is not an effective altruist, but two of the members of the board were, or at least are heavily affiliated with it, just to cover our bases. And those two people were kind of, it was surprising that they had come to have such influence at the company. They had no real firm association outside of that. One of them was an academic, not really in the corporate world at all. Maybe that, you know, as a result of, you know, its nonprofit origins. And they became really, really worried that Sam Altman, Greg, everyone that kind of stood with him was moving too fast, you know, breaking things, blah, blah, blah. And so those two factions, Sam on one side and this woman, Helen Toner, on the other side, started to kind of go at each other. You know, Helen even wrote a paper in which she criticized OpenAI. It was a very academic paper, and celebrated another AI startup. And Sam was like, what the hell? And she was like, well, it's an academic paper. And he was like, everything you say matters to this company. And so they were kind of butting heads with each other. And increasingly, someone in the middle was the company's chief scientist, Eliot Setskever, who, you know, worked with Sam, but also was really much a big time doomer. And so he was kind of found himself in the middle. And he consequently also was the person who kind of invited Sam onto the Zoom call or the Google Hangout and said, you know, we've got some news to share with you, you know, and you can see, you know what happened next.
They're not using Microsoft Teams to do that. That feels very not aligned with the brand.
that I think when the reporting came out, I cannot believe I cannot imagine Microsoft was super happy about that. But yeah, Google
Hangouts. I'm sorry. Does anyone like Teams? No one likes Teams.
I've never used it.
No one likes Teams. Come on.
My Karen uses it all the time, and it does not look good.
I'm sure even the Microsoft employees are using it reluctantly, let's be honest.
And Microsoft is important to this story, just as an aside, before we dig into some of the other stuff, some of the other wild things. They injected, what, $13 billion? They had the $13 billion investment?
$13 billion. So, as I've said, I know there's like a million different aspects of this story, and that's why everyone's so confused. But, you know, just to try and put the Microsoft thing in context. So, OpenAI was a nonprofit. Elon Musk was associated. Elon Musk decides he's bailing. They go, oh, we need money. It requires a lot of money to build a complex AI system. It ends up, of course. And so they go, let's kind of reformat this, create this for-profit arm. We can use it to get investment. Microsoft goes, great. We would love to give you first $1 billion and ultimately $13 billion. So they own technically 49% of the company. But unlike a typical corporate structure, you know, an investor that owns 49% of generic corporation X has a lot of sway in the decision making of that company because the board is beholden to the shareholders, so the shareholders can exert a lot of influence. OpenAI actually is not like that. The board is not, its mandate is not to please shareholders. It's to make sure effectively that AI is developed in a safe way and doesn't take over the world and that Terminator doesn't come to pass. And so as a result, you know, Microsoft had invested all this money and did not have any, you know, legal effective power at the company. And so they were, you know, when they found out that, go ahead.
So I just want to make sure that I understand. So there's a nonprofit with the board, and that nonprofit is in control of the for-profit company that Microsoft has invested in.
Exactly. And that board is very small.
And that board is very small. And those two entities are separate enough that if you are Microsoft and you invest the billions into the for-profit thing, you don't have much control over it.
Yeah, and I mean, until Friday, there had been a pretty good argument that, you know, they were creating a better version of a corporation, you know, a better version of a business, at least, you know, one in which we can take all this money from Microsoft so that we can build all these fancy toys, but we're not, you know, in the end of the day, just like a shareholder capitalist function. Well, our shareholder, we're not just beholden to shareholders. We, in fact, have a higher mission. We're going to create a responsible AI, a better AI. And as a result, we've created a better system. That looked great until Friday when, you know, obviously shit hit the fan.
It's funny is when all of this originally went down, I joked to myself in my own head because I remember maybe like a week ago, a hot Sam Altman quote dropped where he said that AGI is going to be a magic intelligence in the sky. And I was like, oh, it sounds like they're trying to build God or something. I wonder if that's why they fired him. It sounds like something like that may actually be at the root of this.
I think the root conflict is very similar to that. Yes. Sam, well, one way to think about it would be Sam Altman, and I'm generalizing here, but if you'll let me, Sam Altman is the Silicon Valley move fast and break things guy at the company. And then you have the, you know, more conservative members of the board and this guy, Ilya Sutskever, who is the chief scientist, and they are the, we could destroy the world. Everything could end as a result of what we are building right now. And so those two factions were constantly kind of at each other's throat. I don't know which is right, but, you know, I could say for sure that that was creating a lot of conflict at the company at the highest levels.
What? Okay. It just the whole thing is so strange. It's just like that was really what I learned watching all because I was not paying attention to the corporate structure of OpenAI. You know, I was interested in ChatGPT and AI and their effects on society and my job, obviously. But I had not, I didn't realize how weird it was at the top of this thing. Will you tell me? So we know who the chief scientist is. Who are the other people on the board?
I'll tell you who they were 2 days ago, and I'll tell you who they were now. How does that sound?
This is, I love this. This is great.
Yeah, like what, yeah, the, because I assume that when you lose a fight like this, you maybe don't get to stick around, right?
It's a, yes. So, let's say a year ago, there were 9 people on the board. 3 of them left. Some of them were like Reid Hoffman, but blah, blah. We don't have to get bogged down in that. Then there were 6. Sam Altman, Greg Brockman, Move Fast and Break Things. Then you had the 4 others that voted against them in the end. One was Ilyat Setskever, the chief scientist, little bit doomy, but loves AI. Then you had, weirdly, for reasons I still can't quite understand, Adam D'Angelo, who's the Quora CEO. And then you had 2 other people. Tasha McCauley and Helen Toner, these are the effective altruist types. One of them is weirdly married to Joseph Gordon-Levitt, just as an aside.
Wait. Really?
That is true, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
So he's just giving you a little bit of flavor. So anyway, that was the 6. You had Greg and Sam on one side versus these 4 others. The 4, you know, kick them out effectively. Well, kick Sam out, Greg leaves. And blah, 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 infighting. It's all blown up through this deal that got cut basically last night. And now you have only 3 people on the board as of today. The Quora guy remains. And then you have 2 kind of weird characters come in. One is Brett Taylor, who used to run the Twitter board, and he shoved the deal down Musk's throat. He's kind of like your kind of classic old school Silicon Valley type, former CTO of Facebook. And then for reasons I really, really, really cannot understand, Larry Summers, who is just like a strange character that continues to pop up in the American story, former Treasury Secretary, former Clinton guy, former Obama guy, former president of Harvard, somehow weirdly involved in seemingly every major crisis in American history. So you've only got 3 people there now. Now, supposedly they're going to grow it, but who knows? So, I mean, this is a huge blow up overnight.
And the structure isn't changing.
Structure is not changing as far as I know. You know, by the time you publish this podcast, maybe it will. That's why it's really
hard
to talk
about.
For the record,
it is 11:30 a.m. on November 22nd. Again, it is 11:30 a.m. on November 22nd.
It's hard to say anything. You know, there's lots that we don't know. But I do know that the effective altruists, and they are also, you know, I don't want to just boil them down to that alone. They are, you know, also entrepreneurs and researchers in their own rights. And I do think there's validity to being concerned about AI, but they are gone. They've cut a deal. And as part of that deal, Sam can come back, but he can't be on the board. And he has to undergo an investigation into the vague claims that they had made about his communication issues. So there's all sorts of weird deal making happening. I mean, personally, I think they really screwed it up and blew their hand, but you know, that's just me.
Yeah, could talk about the board issued a statement. Maybe that's the wrong way to say it. The board said that the reason they fired him was that he had weird communication issues, right?
Yeah, that's what they said. And then everyone was like, "Well, what does that mean? Did he pull a Sam Bankman-Fried? Did he lie to the board? Did he?" I don't know. There was all sorts of speculation about what it was publicly and at the company. They were like, what did he do? What did he do that caused you to do this? And you know what? Ironically, the accusation they leveled about him was that he wasn't good at communicating. But ever since they put out that statement, their communication has been ridiculously bad, both in the company, just saying, it wasn't safety. It wasn't financial malfeasance, but not ever saying what it was. And they also, and this is my personal opinion, absolutely screwed it publicly, because once they put out that statement, they basically went silent, and Sam was able to drive the conversation through the media. And then, like, we still don't know what their argument was. And that was like a huge, huge misstep. It, to me, it seems like they're kind of more academically focused people who are a little bit out of their league in sort of this sort of succession type story. But yeah, they never said anything, and they should, and in my opinion, they should have. I mean, even if they had to leak it through the press, because, like, one, I want to know. And two, if that was it, that's, you know, that's pretty weak to just say that someone has communication issues and leave it at that. And I'm not really a Sam Altman defender. Like, I don't believe that this guy is God. I think he's like a deal making, you know, he's a deal maker. He's not even like the genius behind the, all of the technological breakthroughs, but like they really screwed the pooch is what I think personally.
And I mean, after, you know, as this was all going on, there was that letter from all of those OpenAI employees who were basically saying, bring Sam back. This is ridiculous. And I remember, you know, this all happened so fast. So please do correct me if I am bungling anything. Wasn't it basically
And if you get anything wrong about this story, it's completely fine. If I get anything wrong about this story, maybe a little bit less fine, but still, I think socially acceptable, because the amount of stuff that's come out about this over the last 5 days, it's
five
pretty
years.
Hard to keep
your, yeah, yeah, I feel like as an, feels like five as a years. Total aside, I feel like, you know, as we were getting to record, like, you know, getting ready to record this morning, I feel like I woke up, saw that Sam Altman was once again named the CEO of OpenAI or the head of the board or whatever, and I was like, you know, I guess we've done a lot of, there's been a lot of stuff happening, but none of it matters now.
Exactly.
We literally just spent a week going around and getting back to the start.
Yeah. I mean, that there's a whole moral somewhere in there, although I'm not sure what it is. But to answer your earlier question, yeah, I mean, the employees were completely behind Sam. And I think that was actually a really important reason that, the members of the board ended up cutting a deal to bring him back, because, you know, they claimed, oh, they're all about safety. And I believe that they really are, the members of the board that were really concerned about it. But then what happened was you had 770 employees saying, if you don't bring him back and you don't resign, we're just going to quit and go elsewhere. And then you have a real problem on your hand that I think actually is arguably an even worse safety issue, which is that you have this incredibly influential technology with no one literally running it that had created it. And that, you know, we know is a problem. I mean, you can look at like what happened to Twitter after they got rid of everyone. It became a disaster. The idea that ChatGPT, something similar could happen to ChatGPT, which people are just putting in like untold amounts of information to every day, was really scary. So I think that, you know, it's not how I would exert my influence as an employee, but, you know, they wanted to do it to bring back their boss, and they were successful.
All right, cyber listeners, we're going to pause there for a break. We'll be right back after this.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, cyber listeners, we are once again on talking about OpenAI. So for a little while, in the liminal space that we all lived, and may still, in fact, be living in, Microsoft was going to scoop up everybody.
I guess so, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, but like I said, Microsoft had no legal power as a shareholder in this situation, but they did try as hard as they could to exert control over it. So, you know, Microsoft's CEO is really pissed off that he didn't get any notice about what was happening on Friday. And then he was trying to ram Sam back into the organization on Sunday. And then when they went instead with the Twitch guy, he was like, well, I'm just going to hire them all myself then. So he was like, if you work at OpenAI and you want to come work for Microsoft, come on over. And so I think that he was also, I mean, in retrospect, definitely trying to exert pressure on OpenAI to say, bring this guy back or we're literally going to take this thing down.
I want to highlight some of the wilder characters in this before we put a bow on where we are at the moment. So for a hot minute, Emmett Shear was going to be in charge. Who is Emmett Shear? What is weird about him?
What's weird about Emmett Shear, the Twitch CEO and Twitch guy? He, according to his Twitter, a lot of things. Right after he got
it,
a lot of surfacing of tweets. How can we say of a questionable matter about some of his theories on questions about sexuality. I'll leave the listeners to look that up themselves. Probably shows that they did not have a huge amount of vetting in the 2 hours before they named him. I think the main thing about Emmett was that he was a doomer. He had referred to compared AI to a 10x fusion bomb. And had basically just said, you know, if OpenAI was moving at level 10, he thought that they should be moving at level 1 or 2. And so I think that appealed to the board, basically, especially the people, the side of the board that wanted to move slow. So he got brought in and did a commendable job for about, I don't know, 24 hours.
Strange that there is this company that seems to be one of the, other than like some defense tech stuff, one of the like big going concerns in Silicon Valley, that is the hot ticket, that was run by people who thought that they were building a nuke and maybe shouldn't do it.
Right. It's a very strange situation that I still have a little bit of trouble wrapping my head around. And it's made me think, should the people, it's a failure of self-regulation, I think, if nothing else, you know, should the people within the company be responsible for putting the brakes on a potentially world-changing, world-altering, world-destroying technology? I think, you know, the evidence from this weekend says we shouldn't at least on our own trust them to be responsible for that.
Anyone who appears as a character in a Reddit atheist-aligned Harry Potter fanfic should not be in charge of anything.
Oh my God, how could I forget the fanfic?
Don't do this to me.
I'm sorry. You know about this, right?
I very much know about this. This is going to be a very, very brief overview, which is because I am... Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality is a fan fiction that I know of basically in name only, and that it's like this huge Harry Potter fan fiction that Emmett Shear is a named character in. 404 Media did an article about it last night that I haven't read yet because I try to do what I can to preserve my sanity as much as I can. And knowing things about the Harry Potter fan fiction world drama, I've sworn off that. So
it's written by a guy, Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality, is written by a guy who's like the founder of Less Wrong and is one of these big like Reddit atheist extreme rationality guys who had an op-ed in Time, maybe the middle of last year, about why AI is going to lead to the nuclear apocalypse. He's extremely doomery. He's one of the guys that thinks like we're going to hook up AI to like 3D printers, and the 3D printers are going to make diseases that will kill all of humanity, because why would AI not do that? It's the rational thing for AI to do. And so, like, Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality is like this big fanfic opus that he wrote, that's like a way to rational pill Harry Potter fans. The whole thing is so weird.
Is this something I have to read, or that I can avoid for the rest of my life?
I don't think anybody in the year 2023 needs to read a Harry Potter fanfic.
Yeah.
I think we're good.
Harry Potter's time is well past us.
No offense to my friends who still do that, but you know, let's keep it 100 here.
Yeah, especially when it's like Reddit rational Harry. Like nobody wants that. Go read My Immortal instead.
Exactly. Thank you.
So the other person I just want to have some words said about is the chief scientist. So there's some stuff written in The Atlantic about him and how he's kind of, we've already said that he's a weirdo, but he would do things like lead chants at the company.
Ilya Sutskever, probably the most interesting person in this whole tale of corporate intrigue. I guess the main thing that I would say is that he is well regarded as a complete genius. He is like a AI deep learning genius, one of the most well respected people in the field in the pure nuts and bolts of deep learning. He came from the academic world. He did a little bit of Google stuff. Musk personally recruited him over to OpenAI. But he also is super into the sort of doomer safety side. And so, you know, he created a sort of, I'm trying to think about how to even describe this. he basically burned something in effigy that was supposed to represent, a bad AI, and he was supposed to be burning away all of like these bad AI.
He made a totem.
Yeah,
he made a totem to burn an effigy as like a religious ritual to burn away the bad AI.
Exactly. Right? And I think there was sort of almost a spiritual component to his belief. So on the one hand, you had this really hard line belief in the power of deep learning and AI. And on the other hand, he had this sort of spiritual side that said, you know, we have to remain cognizant of the fact that this can destroy the world. And like we were talking about earlier, it's a confusing dichotomy that he is so obsessed with building it and simultaneously, you know, like absolutely terrified of what he could be building. But yeah, I mean, he, as a result of that, became increasingly concerned about Altman. He eventually went to the board with its concerns. He's, you know, was worried that Altman was, you know, heading down a path that, you know, was the antithesis of what OpenAI should represent. He was the one who called Altman into the board meeting to get him fired. If he didn't do the firing himself, he very well might have. And then, bizarrely, he switched and called for Altman to return, probably maybe because of pressure from the other employees. But he's just been all over the place. I mean, philosophically, he's building the thing and terrified of it. He, you know, wanted Altman fired, and then 3 days later was saying what a horrible mistake he was. He might well represent OpenAI better than anyone else because he has the tools, but he also seems to not quite understand the corporate world and how to make moves inside large, complex organizations.
I love watching dudes struggle with the idea of God and how they're unable to resolve it, and then, like, what happens after. Like, so many people, like, get real into atheism, and then things can get really strange afterwards.
Right.
It's like we've got the tools to build what I would think of as a classical image of like God as this thing in the sky that watches over us. We should do that. That sounds like a great idea,
right?
Says some of the AI scientists.
I guess the thinking is like someone's going to build it. We should be the ones who, since we're like the responsible ones, but I think that might be a good theory that might not have realistic applications.
Yeah, you're spending too much time talking to your word calculator, buddy.
Right, exactly.
You're doing some projection there, yeah, I think.
Right.
So let's expand this out away from OpenAI if we can. You also wrote this great piece before this, kind of about Wall Street's love affair with the idea of AI in general. You know, we're at this era where we're post-crypto crash, where there's kind of this big, I would say, like, drive to find what the next tech bubble was going to be. And I would say we're firmly in the middle of the AI tech bubble, right?
Definitely. I think, you know, when Wall Street sees new, they see opportunity. And, you know, I think that they search for a technological breakthrough might mean, you know, some innovation that leads to a productivity increase that leads to more profits, that means that they should invest in the company. That's one side of it. What I was interested in is how they're planning to use AI within the banks themselves. So, I mean, Jamie Dimon, CEO of the biggest bank by assets in the US, you know, he said that it's going to be critical to his company's future success. And, you know, they're already toying with ways to, you know, summarize legal documents, sift through, earnings reports, you know, sift through news reports. That stuff I think is really interesting. There's cybersecurity elements, blah, blah, blah. What I'm really interested in is this kind of fringe that is testing using AI to make investment decisions, you know, like, let's entrust the AI to tell us to invest in company X, Y, and Z, and how much to invest, and then to switch over to company B. That is a really big change that I think is pretty interesting. And while it's on the fringe, I suspect it's on the fringe in the way that 15 years from now, it will be part of the mainstream.
Yeah, Wall Street embraces this kind of thing pretty readily most of the time, right? Like, they were a big reason that we've got some of the internet infrastructure we do in the country is so that they can make lightning fast trades from coast to coast.
Yeah. I mean, Wall Street is always looking for an edge. I mean, that's the whole game. Financial innovation essentially is looking for a way to repackage new things to old things to make them look new. Or, you know, to figure out a way that they can be slightly better than the trading firm across the street. So, yeah, they're always looking for an edge, and computers have increasingly been a part of that. That's why we had high frequency trading become so popular, over this century. It allowed them to kind of trade faster, get an edge, and occasionally create a flash crash that would take away billions in shareholder value in a couple seconds.
Is it possible that, so like, what can you get in kind of the nuts and bolts of what they're talking about actually doing with the AI?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different stuff. I mean, you know, on a more basic level of what's already happening, Vanguard, a big financial institution, is using AI to generate retirement portfolios. Morgan Stanley has sort of a ChatGPT assistant for financial advisors, help them kind of interact with clients. JP Morgan Chase has created a patent for something called IndexGPT. Well, supposedly that's going to help traders decide where to invest. And then there's people on, like I said, you know, there's people whose entire investment thesis is based on the development of an AI that tells them where to invest. And then there's also people who are trying to use large language models, ChatGPT type things to, you know, help traders, say, like, help me follow 50 stocks 24/7. Help me, you know, understand the financial rule that through which I can make bet X, Y, and Z. So they're trying all sorts of things. To varying degrees of success, I think, you know, so far, I think, you know, AI has not been able to beat the market, let's say.
Is this any different from say, bots that have already been deployed. I mean, we've had those for years, right? Sam Bankman-Fried was using one, I think both at FTX and Jane Street.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it is different. Definitely the use of large language models to try and make decisions, financial decisions, as a sort of assistant is a different sort of innovation that we haven't seen before. Comes with concerns because a lot of large language models tend to be wrong a lot of the time. So that could be a concern. I think also, you know, the idea of using complex, you know, generative AI to create a portfolio is a different sort of thing than just using a bot. I mean, Betterment is like a robo-advisor. And they kind of have algorithms or models that they create and then allow it to kind of do its thing. That is different from having a sort of quote unquote smart, generative AI that's sort of making the decisions on its own, learning, you know, and developing a thesis as we go. That is different. It's, you know, potentially creates more autonomy by the AI, which could be, of concern if it makes a incorrect decision and invests, you know, $10 trillion into, I don't know, bookstores or something like that, you know, and then, you know, everyone's like, wait, why have we overinvested in bookstores? Creates a bubble crash. I think that's the concern.
I'm sure Michael Lewis will write a wonderful book.
I'm sure that he will. Hopefully he, find someone who isn't committing a major massive fraud to profile this time.
Well, he would profile the AI and really humanize it.
Sure. In a very touching manner, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just want a social network of this entire year's, you know, tech rise and downfall.
Oh, my God.
When are we getting that is my question.
I promise you that there are 45 agents in Hollywood right now fighting for, you know, 10 scripts or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Whichever one can sign Trent Reznor to do the score, just let me know when that's
exactly
out.
Exactly.
I would love Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Sam Altman.
It needs to be an inside job.
Yeah. It's the they hire Aaron Sorkin to write their version of what happened.
The movie I want to see is Sam Bankman-Fried versus the Binance CEO, you know, like kind of like they were rivals. And it seems yes. like the Binance CEO like basically took down or started Sam Bankman's free fall. And then, you know, he fell, you know, this week he fell as well.
And then we made fun of the Michael Lewis book, but I actually do think there's a lot of good stuff in there. And a lot of the Binance, a lot of the stuff between them, he captures their like interpersonal rivalry pretty well. And it's pretty fascinating. Also, nice segue.
I know how to segue. What can I say?
Yeah, what's going on here? So we're a year out from the crypto crash. We're deep in the aftermath. CZ was kind of one of the last guys standing, right?
Yeah, CZ Changpeng Zhao is the CEO of Binance, which is the world's largest crypto exchange. I think Sam Bankman-Fried and him were, you know, they were the big rivals, the big two of the industry. And I think, you know, ironically, Sam fell first. I think there were always a few more questions about CZ. He lives in the UAE. They really had no company headquarters. There were all sorts of sketchy seeming things that were happening. But after Sam Bankman-Fried fell, he was like kind of the last man standing in a lot of ways. But as these things go, the U.S. federal agencies were well underway in a long investigation into all sorts of stuff that, well, I guess we can say now was completely illegal. And so this week he kind of surprisingly said that he would step down, plead guilty to a criminal charge. And so he's out at Binance. The company is going to pay a $4 billion fine related to charges like, you know,
allowing Americans to trade with Iranians and Russians and things like that, which is against the law for all sorts of reasons. And but Binance will continue under a new CEO. I think that was a big part of the deal. But it's a fall from grace, and it's almost so much faster and less dramatic that I think it's going to go a little bit more under the radar than Sam's.
Well, he wasn't the CZ was never as big like a personality or a character as Sam was, right? Sam was hanging out with football stars and was very seen. And was trying to be the face of this thing in a way that CZ wasn't.
I think Sam was trying to be the face for like the general person who didn't know who crypto was. You know, your mom's face of crypto is what Sam was. I think CZ, I think, instead has sort of like, I mean, in the crypto space, he was like a god. You know, they were like bowed down to him. They just thought he was an absolute genius. Smarter than everyone else, you know, always seemed to be a step ahead of the U.S., kind of laughing at the federal agencies, pretending to be in compliance and then saying, you know, no KYC behind the scenes. I mean, he was, you know, he kind of represented a little bit of like the thumbing of the nose, at, you know, people who thought that, you know, the rules should apply to them. And, you know, like their whole mantra is to create a freer flow of money, and it seems like they definitely did that, because the money was flowing pretty freely between or at least through them and some terrorist organizations, it came out.
Yeah, it turns out you can't just invent securities out of whole cloth and then say they're not securities and shouldn't be regulated like securities.
Yeah, I mean, that, I think, plays more into SEC investigation that's ongoing, so we have not seen the last of it, but seems like he's going to go into the background. He's saying that he's going to take some time off, maybe start investing a little. Maybe I know the funniest thing was that he was like, and I might make myself available for mentoring if people are interested.
I don't know if that's a good idea or not. I don't know.
I mean, it's a pretty crazy thing to say. Like, hey, I just stepped down from my organization and pled guilty. You know, my company had to pay a $4 billion fine. I'm basically a disgrace now, and I'm available if you want to, you know, chat about, you know, how to start your startup.
Just put time on my calendar.
Yeah, exactly.
You learn more from failure than you do from success.
That's true. Definitely true. And in that way, I guess he has a lot to tell people.
Like, would you rather talk to Napoleon right after the bat, like right, you know, right at the height of his power, or do you want to interview Napoleon when he's in exile on the island?
Yeah, I will say I'm joking a little bit. I'm obviously saying these things in jest. I don't really feel the need to be super kind to CZ, but he did say, you know, like at a minimum, I'll tell you what not to do. You know, if you're my mentee, I'll tell you what mistakes to avoid.
Good times. All right, Maxwell, I think that about covers this week's wild news. Thank you so much for coming on to Cyber. Everyone enjoy your Thanksgiving.
Have a good Thanksgiving, guys.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Transitioning to a decarbonized economy sounds like just one change. In fact, this shift requires several transitions across sectors, geographies, and timelines. In Talking Transitions, a new podcast brought to you by the EY organization and Foresight Climate and Energy, we look at how the transition is affecting three key areas: energy, financial services, and government. The Talking Transitions podcast is out now. Download today from wherever you get your podcasts, or visit talkingtransitions.com to find out more.